Hi, I'm Dr. Pam Peek, and welcome to episode 175 of Her, the podcast where you'll hear the naked truth about her mind, her body, her life, and her work as, wait a minute, her work? What about her work? Is the workplace really like a family place? Uh-oh. Yeah, we got the answers to that one. Hang on. We have a terrific show coming up. Just know that this episode is made possible by our wonderful friends at Smarty Pants Women's Vitamins, the delicious once-a-day gummies that contain all of the essential vitamins, minerals, and omega oils customized just for women. To learn more, hop on over to SmartyPantsVitamins.com. And here's your reminder to click on to iTunes after this episode to rate and review this show. Yeah, I sit around waiting for you. Uh-huh. I want to hear your reviews. I want your feedback. I just love to hear from you. So please don't disappoint me. Make sure to rate and review, and I'll remind you later on. All right, it's time for Her.
Her, the podcast.
The naked truth about women.
Her mind, her body, her life. It's all about her.
So I'm just reading this fabulous column that Tim Herrera writes in the New York Times. And in this column, he's talking to an expert, our guest, all about, wait a minute, is the workplace really like a family place? I mean, seriously, we're like family here. Is that really an okay thing, or is that all wrong? What's going on with that? Allison Green is our guest, and she wrote a book called Ask a Manager, and this is based on her wonderful blogs, How to Navigate Clueless Colleagues, Lunch-Stealing Bosses, and the Rest of Your Life at Work. That just about, you know, kind of takes care of the whole damn thing right there. Allison writes the popular Ask a Manager blog. All you got to do is run on over to askamanager.org and read it. It is absolutely superb. Very entertaining, incredibly informative. Y'all better be reading it, where she answers readers' questions daily on all kinds of workplace issues, from what to say when you drank too much at a company party, never happened, to what to do if you're allergic to your boss's perfume. Ew. Bravo TV called Allison the Dear Abby of the work world, and she's the author of this wonderful book, Ask a Manager, as I just said. Allison, welcome to the Her podcast.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Why isn't the workplace more like family? Why can't we just say we're all family here? We're like family here. What's that about?
People do love to say that. And I want to say up front, work can absolutely be a place where you have very warm, very caring relationships with your colleagues. There's nothing wrong with that. The problem that you run into with we're like a family here is that it is often used in ways that really put workers at a disadvantage. It often means that their boundaries are going to be violated. They're going to be expected to show excessive amounts of loyalty and commitment, even when it's not in their best interest. It tends to make people feel really guilty about doing things like saying no to unreasonable hours or pushing for a raise. And it tends to only be one way. It tends to be employees who feel guilty if they think of themselves like a family, not the company's management.
Oh, how interesting. You know, I've dealt with many companies. I actually am an operating advisor to a large private equity firm. And, you know, I've watched a number of different kinds of companies function within the healthy living and aging space. And one of the things that was the stickiest was when you get really close to one another, like family. I mean, super close. I mean, you're doing Christmases together. I mean, I don't mean at the office party, but you're tight. And you're golfing every single week together or whatever. I don't golf, so, you know, I can't identify. But you're doing something each week together like that, et cetera. And then one of the toughest things is when you find out that one of those two people runs into a major problem at work, and maybe that person has to be let go, and maybe you're the person who has to let that person go. And I've watched it just rip relationships to shreds, and leave people, you know, dangling and feeling really rotten. Thus came a phrase from that one company, be friendly, not friends. Is that right? Is that the right way
yes,
to go?
That is perfect. Be friendly, be warm, be caring, be compassionate. But ultimately, these are business relationships. And getting that close makes things very messy. Not only might one of the parties need to fire or lay someone off one day, they have to be able to give objective feedback. They have to be able to say, hey, here's a really serious problem with your work. And they have to have other people see them as objective. If you're really close to an employee, it's pretty likely that other people on your team are going to suspect there's some favoritism going on there. Whether or not there really is almost beside the point, because the perception will be that there's favoritism, that that person has extra access to you, that there might be bias in terms of work assignments or raises or promotions. And if someone ever has a problem with that employee one day, if they need to report, say, harassment, they might not be comfortable doing that, because if they see that you're very close with this employee, you're golfing with them every weekend, they're not going to trust you to handle a complaint about that employee in a fair-handed way.
Okay, now I got a hot one for you. Is it women or men who are the big offenders on this one?
You know, I think people think it's women because women tend to put more emphasis on social relationships, certainly. But I've seen men be just as big of offenders as women. And certainly when it comes to throwing around that line that we're like family here, I think that one is equal opportunity.
Ah, see, now that was an important one, because I think there's a little bias out there. You know, women tend to befriend. Remember, you know, they always say that as a little phrase out there. I wonder. The other thing I note, and perhaps you've spoken to in your multiple blogs, is, you know, you get cliques at work, right? And, you know, you can have everything from mean girl cliques. I mean, it's like high school all over again, to the varsity guys and all of that. And when these cliques start coming together, things start getting really hairy. You know, how does a woman break into a golf clique when she doesn't like golf and the guys are the ones who are kind of aggregating to do the golf on a routine basis, et cetera? What do you have to say about that? Because, you know, this is a real phenomenon.
Yeah, absolutely. And golf is the perfect example because that's been going on for decades. Women used to be very systematically shut out of playing golf, and it can be a real problem professionally. I think if you're a manager or anyone in a position of leadership in a company, you need to be really thoughtful about what these informal groupings that are happening are, even if it's outside of work. And if there is something like that tends to be male-dominated, you do need to step in and break that up. And sometimes people think, well, if it's on my own time and it's just a social activity, why shouldn't people be able to get together and socialize in the way that they want to? And sure, if this weren't a work context, absolutely that would be true. But this stuff impacts people at work. It impacts the face time that women get and the opportunities that women get. So companies have to really be thoughtful about making sure that they're not creating ghettos of just men or of just women and that they're being inclusive.
Yeah, I mean, the other piece, too, is that mean girl thing. You know what I'm talking about. So you
sure.
get this little clique of women who, you know, whatever. I mean, I've seen this, for instance, at magazines where you tend to have a larger number of women working, and you've got that thing going. I think women can be just as mean as, exclusive, as it were. But really, at the end of the day, let's go back to the as family thing. Now, I would imagine, and I'd love to hear your insights from all that you've researched and worked, what happens when the founders are basically like CEO and COO? What if they live together, they work together, maybe they're partners, I mean, like partners, like either spouses or, you know, live-in partners, however. How does that work? Because you're already showing up attached.
It often can get messy. I think if you are leading a company with your spouse or life partner, you have to be really careful about watching how that shows up at work. You can't bring the relationship into the office. You need to make sure that people would feel comfortable approaching one of you about an issue with another, if that isn't going to be realistic, and it might not be realistic for a lot of married couples, there has to be someone else who is deputized to be able to deal with those sorts of problems so people have somewhere to go. Worst case scenario here, let's say one of those people at the top is sexually harassing someone. People probably aren't going to want to report that to their spouse. There has to be some other avenue for reporting. That's an example of the kind of thing that you have to think about. But I think, too, with small companies in particular, which is where this warlike family thing often crops up, I think it's so tempting to feel like, especially as you say, if your founders are literally family, it's so tempting to feel like creating a family-like atmosphere at work will make it a warmer, more pleasant environment for people. And often at the start, it does. But over time, it tends to play out in ways that are very problematic. You get people feeling like they can't advocate for themselves. You get people feeling guilty if they quit for a better job. You get people feeling pressured. And this isn't the intent when people say we're like family. This is not generally what they're going for. It's not an evil plan. But the way it plays out is that you get people feeling guilty about making decisions that are in their best interest.
Yeah, I can see how that gets weird. You know, there's that other phrase, it's a family business, right? It's been in the family for, you know, generations. I don't know, however you want to play that. That can get, when someone says that, like you're entering a family business, does that immediately change up the context within which you're working? You know what I'm saying? In your mind, you're saying to yourself, whoa, you know, I'm entering a family business, and the family itself can be all over the place. You know, like now it's being run by the grandchildren, right? And one grandchild is the head of marketing. Another one is, you know, maybe doing some IT or something. They're all over the place. You know, how hairy does that get?
It can get pretty hairy. It depends on the business, of course. I mean, there are family businesses that are very professionally run, and you would never know that there were family members in different positions unless someone told you. But it's also true, particularly at smaller family businesses, that it can be kind of its own breed of organization. You might get people who have their jobs not based on merit, but because they're a family member. You might get family drama that bleeds into your life at work. I mean, families can be very messy, and you don't necessarily want those dynamics in your workplace. So it depends. I mean, there are some family businesses that are very committed to running a tight ship and being very rigorous and running in a polished professional way, and that's great. But there are others that aren't. So I think if someone is contemplating taking a job at a family business, it's good to ask a lot of questions about culture, talk to other people who work there, and make sure that you know what you're walking into.
Okay, I think that could get really funky, you know, very quickly. I just, you know, there was a quote from that article that you were quoted in by Tim Herrera in the New York Times. That was kind of interesting. He said, Reed Hastings of Netflix has a famously shrewd outlook on this whole concept. A workplace is a team, and if a teammate isn't performing well enough, they must be cut for the good of the team. Adequate performance gets a generous severance package. Harsh. And then he asked you, but is that a healthier way to think about work?
I do think it's a healthier way. The way that is stated does sound very harsh. But it is true that work is much more like a team than it is like a family. A team is a better framework to look at it in. We're all working together toward a particular goal, and if someone isn't pulling their weight, you should coach them, as you would on, say, a sports team. You should give them coaching. You should try to see if you can get them up to the bar that you need. But at some point, if it turns out that you're not getting what you need from the person and it doesn't look like you're going to be able to, it does make sense to part ways. And if you don't, if you keep that person on, that's a lot of weight that you're transferring to other members of the team who are going to have to pick up that person's slack. And, you know, ultimately, it is business. We can sometimes be uncomfortable with that concept, but it is business. And we're both on the employee side and on the management side. We're both looking to get something out of that business relationship. And if either side realizes that they're not getting it, it's okay to go look for it somewhere else, whether that means finding an employee to replace the one who's not working or finding a job, a different job that will give you more of what you're looking for.
Okay. Well, I mean, I'm totally on board with your answer. It sounds like it makes a heck of a lot of sense to me. Now I want to go to an interesting place. You know, if you're working wherever you're working, whether it's Google or a family business or whatever. I think a lot of how you perceive the workplace is based upon where you are coming from in your own social life and your personal life, too. When we think of the number of hours that we spend in a day at work, quite frankly, we're at work longer than we are home. I mean, conscious anyway, at home, you know, for so many people. I mean, we just are. It's just the way the work week is. We're commuting. We're away from home. We're working. We're doing our thing. There you have it. Now, if you've got social obligations, you have, you know, some kind of family at home or, you know, partner, however you're working it, that's one thing. So you perceive things as, okay, I've got to achieve an appropriate balance here and really look at my boundaries. What if you don't have any of that? How many people out there are living alone, are fairly lonely, and really now depend upon the workplace almost as their family?
That's really interesting. I do think that happens. And I think it's important to make sure that you're bringing balance to your life, regardless of what you have going on at home. You know, if you don't have spouse or kids, maybe it's friends or hobbies or volunteering in your community. But it's very easy, especially in certain professions, to really throw yourself into your work and make your work your life. And that can be very fulfilling for a time, but jobs can and do go away. And you want to make sure that you're not putting yourself in a position where if that job does go away, that you feel completely lost.
Huh. Yeah,
I will say that I say that as someone who is guilty of throwing myself into my work. So I definitely understand the pull toward doing that if you like what you do and you get a lot of fulfillment out of it. But it is important to remember, I mean, things change and your job situation may not always be what it is right now. And you want to make sure that you're shoring up the other pieces of your life so that they're there if you need them.
I remember this happening to me almost inadvertently, Allison, and that was when I did my medical residency at a large university, and that was 3 years of basically living, for all intent and purposes, in the hospital. In this case, I really didn't have much of a choice. You're pretty much, you know, on 72 hours, and then you go to a place you call home. It's usually an apartment somewhere with withering lettuce in the fridge that you never touch, and you collapse, wake up, and you start it all over again. And during those three very intense years, you know, it is your home. And I think a lot of professions throw you into a situation like that, whether it's in training or otherwise. And when my residency training was over, that last jubilant, wonderful day, I mean, I enjoyed every moment of it, crazy sleep hours or not. I just love medicine. But I remember staring up at the building, at the big medical center, as I walked away, ready to start the next chapter of my life as a fully trained internist. And I looked at the building and I had this strange feeling, Allison, see if you can go there with me. And I said, my God, I've been there for 3 years. How can they exist without me? They need me this very moment. I got to run in there. Surely there's a patient who needs me, or back and forth. I just couldn't get my brain out of it. It took me like a couple of weeks, you know, of just saying, they're fine. Trust me, they replaced you so fast your head would spin. That's where you suddenly realize there's a cold, objective reality where you establish a relationship in your brain, but that gigantic institution just kept chugging along. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, I love the way you put that. I think people, when they're leaving jobs, often have a version of that experience. I'm sure it's much more intense with the kind of always there medical training that you're talking about. But I think even with leaving 9-to-5 jobs, if you've been there for a while, it does become your home in a way. And it is hard to imagine how will it work without me there. And I think even people who are excited about leaving their job, who are excited about the new job that they're going to, who maybe really weren't happy at the old job and were looking forward to leaving, it can often be kind of bittersweet.
Interesting. Yeah, it's just, and it happens almost inadvertently. And, you know, here's another interesting slice of this. I just think that your work is so amazing, Allison. I just can't. I think there's just so many ideations of this that we could talk about. And that is, you know, what if you just truly are passionate about your work? Now, you said, you know, you raised your hand, busted. Well, you know, definitely I can pretty much honestly say that I've never worked a day in my life because I love what I do so much. And I know it sounds kind of corny and weird, but it's actually true. I pursued medicine because I love it so much, and I do it at all kinds of different places. You know, multimedia, teaching at the university, it goes on and on. And I know that you love what you do. You and I are both writers. And so as fellow writers, we love doing that too. So Allison, is it really true that people are more who are more passionate are more vulnerable for turning their workplace into a family place or just getting way too deep in the weeds and connected? Versus people who are more, I guess, objective and dispassionate?
Oh, that's interesting. I suspect the answer to that is yes. People who are more dispassionate about work, I think, can still get very attached to the social connections at work. You're with the same group of people all day, every day, and you can form very strong relationships there. But I do think you are right that people who are very passionate about their work, very conscientious about their work, are at higher risk for a few of these things. For one, feeling like this place can't possibly go on without me, feeling higher guilt when they leave as a result. And two, yeah, I think the thing we were talking about earlier about feeling a disproportionate sense of obligation to their workplace that can lead them to make decisions that aren't in their best interest. I do think that you see that more with people who love their work and are so invested in it that it's very hard to separate out all the different threads.
All right. Now, is there an age or demographic difference? I'm trying to think of like how a millennial would handle this versus, say, someone who's 55. What do you think?
Interesting. I do think that people who are younger, who are newer to the work world, are more at risk for falling prey to this idea that work is like a family because they don't have a lot of frame of reference, a lot of other workplaces to compare it to. And it's very easy when you're starting out in your career to think that whatever you see around you at work in the beginning is normal. And sometimes it is, but sometimes it's pretty out there and pretty dysfunctional. And it's harder to recognize that if you don't have a lot of other experiences to compare it to. And I think that people who have some experience under them, who are older, often, not always, but often are busier with families and other outside commitments. And it's easier to keep healthy boundaries at work. Not always, not across the board, but if we're speaking in generalities, I do see those patterns. I will say I get a ton of letters from people who are in their 20s, who are just like in their first few years out of school and working, who are trying to figure out, is what's going on in my workplace normal? Is this seems really toxic and dysfunctional to me, but is this just how work works and I should accept it? Or who write into me and they're not asking that question, but they should be. And they mention very casually in passing something that's highly dysfunctional and it's not registering for them that way because they don't have the experience to spot it.
So the book, Ask a Manager How to Navigate Clueless Colleagues, Lunch-Stealing Bosses, and the Rest of Your Life at Work. Thank you for summarizing, Allison. Where can they learn more about your work and the book?
AskAManager.org is my website, and I answer questions every day there from people who are trying to navigate all sorts of weird workplace situations. And you can buy the book, Ask a Manager, at Amazon or anywhere books are sold.
Okay, fantastic. Allison, I can't thank you enough for being on the Herb Podcast, because I think a whole lot of our listeners out there are saying, busted. They've been treating the workplace way too much like a family, and you help set the record straight. Thank you, Allison.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Of course. And everyone out there, please take a minute right now to hit iTunes and rate and review this show. I'm just sitting here waiting to hear from you because this was a really wonderful episode, one that's pretty rich, and I know that's going to resonate with just about every single one of you out there. All right, now I'm Dr. Pam Peek, host of the Herb Podcast. Follow me on Facebook at Dr. Pam Peek or Twitter at Pam Peek MD. And remember to catch every episode of the Herb Podcast on iTunes or Radio MD. Thanks for listening today, and stay well.